Okay, I welcome all of you for English Dhamma discussion, and this was scheduled on Tuesdays, but since Monday Dhammajeeva is not available, we are conducting on Thursday, and we were discussing Tuataka Sutta. So Tuataka Sutta is translated as quickly, doing things quickly. So there again the idea is that Buddha is making a kind of a created Buddha, and that created Buddha is asking questions, and then Buddha is answering those questions. And basically we went through several verses already, and last time actually we have taken one interesting verse, Ajjattameva upasame na anyato bhikkhu santi mesei ajjattam upasantassa natti atta kuto niratta. So that was the verse last time we discussed. Basically, it is mentioning like when someone is internally completely tranquilled, internally composed, and again there is no search of unsuitable means for his calming down or to liberate himself, but he knows exactly what is the path, what are the proper means of achieving it. And for such person, and there is no any kind of wrong views. And actually the commentary and the Sinhala translation mentions those wrong views as the two typically mentioned extreme views, either eternalism, that is Sāsvata Ditti, or the what you call the annihilationism, what is called Uccheda Ditti. So basically, so one is internally quenched, internally satisfied, internally composed. So mind is fairly stilled and internally therefore tranquil. As a result of that, there are no any kind of wrong views. And it can be included even the last, as we discussed last time, it can be included different levels of views. It can be wrong views, extreme wrong views. It can be even the Sakkaya Ditti, the personality view, and even if we go to the more subtle level, it can be asmimana, where the sense of I am. So those are, we can say, we are starting with some gross wrong views, and then we are coming slowly even to the minor, very subtle different types of views. Actually, that is what we discussed last time, and now I think we can go to the next verse. So next verse starts like this. I'll start from the Pali verse. Majje yata samuddhasse omino jayati titho hoti. Evang titho anejasse ussadam bhikkhu na kareya kohinchi. Majje yata samuddhasse omino jayati titho hoti. Evang titho anejasse ussadam bhikkhu na kareya kohinchi. The Sinhala translation going like this. Mahasagaraya ge madhya bhagehi යම්සේ රළ නොහට ගනීද නිශ්චලව සිටියේ වේද එසේන් ශීනාශ්‍රව මහනතෙම අටලෝ දහමින් නොසැලී සිටියේ තෘෂ්ණා රහිත වන්නේය ඒ මහන කිසිවෙක් හුදු උච්ඡද නොකරන්නේය. Now this is a very very interesting verse where you can say how mind may develop from typical worldly level to the higher level, ultimately how an arahant's mind would represent. So the beautiful simile is given with respect to the great ocean. So if you consider the great ocean, so at the beach there are a lot of noise, lot of turbulence, and then as we go further and further, deep and deep, so ultimately it becomes less and less turbulence and less waves, less and less noise, and then when we reach the middle, majje, then it is just deep and just silent and just still. So that is what the verse mentioned. So that can be, actually we can understand very much equal to the mind, how one may start developing during the early level or the worldly level. It is completely turbulent, and as we move forward, it become more and more tranquil, more and more deep, and more and more still. So that is what actually we can understand through the verse, but we can further elaborate this. So I invite Venerable Buddharakkhita to mention the the English translation and the continuation.
So following Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation for this verse, just as in the middle of the ocean, no wave arises, but the ocean remains steady, so too he should be steady without impulse. A bhikkhu should not cause a swelling anywhere. So it's a very interesting metaphor that the Buddha presents here. And again, I'm always reminded when I'm such striking metaphors that Bhikkhu Bodhi himself said one of the striking hallmarks of the Buddha's own composition, or the hallmark of the Buddha was for him these metaphors. And I find them incredibly sort of striking and cinematographic and very fresh and timeless and very pertinent to capturing the previous five verses. So in a way, I mean, in terms of composition, he starts this sutta with a question, and he proceeds to answer that question as the psychic Buddha poses the question, and he answers the question, and then he closes this section by summing up what he's been talking about by this beautiful metaphor. And if we think about it, it's very interesting how a person living in the Ganges River in the agrarian society of that time would have this kind of knowledge about the deep ocean. I'm not aware that he traveled on the ocean, and I'm not aware of how travelers would have met him and informed him about these properties of the ocean. But nevertheless, he has this kind of knowledge of the ocean. And from my point of view, he has a very precise kind of physics knowledge of the ocean as well. I mean, most of us, if listening to this, how do you know that the ocean has no waves? I mean, do you know yourself? And I mean, in recent years, not so long now, it's becoming a long time ago. In 2004, there was a tsunami here in Sri Lanka, and you know, people didn't know that that there was a tsunami wave coming in, because there is no wave on the ocean. We couldn't see it, and it isn't easy to detect. So since that tsunami, they had to put in a lot of special equipment around the Indian Ocean and between here and Indonesia, so that in the future we can detect these kind of shock waves moving through the ocean. But there is no sign of the tsunami until it hits the shoreline. It's not visible out in the ocean itself. So the Buddha has this incredible knowledge of the physical properties of a lot of different aspects of the world, and he can mold these into these metaphors, and then these metaphors are themselves like extremely pertinent to the situation, to the verse that he's describing. So let's now go through this metaphor itself, if we understand that indeed at the depth of the ocean there are no waves arising. So similarly, this is a metaphor for the arahant, that the arahant isn't as such disturbed. So this is a metaphor, the arahant isn't suffering anymore. So there may be the shock waves of pain moving through the arahant, but there isn't the suffering arising. And the arahant, an arahant is described as being steady, as equanimous. Like also another metaphor he gave was like the pillar that holds up the city gate, that it is not immobile. Equanimity is looking out, looking on. It's not bent towards or bending away from the suffering in the world. So he is steady. Again, the arahant is steady, is not shaking, is not grasping to this idea or that idea. So the arahant has full faith or full confidence in the path, in the liberation, because it is has arisen internally. He is not dependent on external ideas or notions or understandings. He has an internal understanding. He has an internal insight and an internal knowledge and wisdom that makes him steady. Otherwise, everybody else is just blown around. So you can be physically blown around, but not in terms of suffering blowing around. And without impulse. So this is without intentionality, the kind of an intentionality that will bring him from lifetime to lifetime. So a lot of people worry about death, but the problem really is rebirth. So he doesn't have that impulse to be reborn again. And a bhikkhu should not cause a stirring anywhere. So again, the stirring is referring to seven different kinds of stirring. So there's the stirring of hatred, the stirring of lust, there's the stirring of conceit, there is the stirring of kamma itself. He doesn't do anything to provoke a kamma. And there is the stirring of defilements. So we have many, many kinds of different stirrings. And this is a metaphor that's a recurring theme of the Buddha as well. So his metaphor is connecting us with other, with previous verses and previous themes. And this is like a recurring idea of his, is that you have these extensions, you have these growths, outgrowths that are ugly, that are swelling. So also the cankers, what he calls the defilements, are stirrings, are like a swelling. So this idea that the waves swell up, that our pride, our haughtiness swells up, our conceitedness swells up, our defilements swell up, our intentionality that causes kamma, the kamma to be reborn, swells up in us. It's a very striking metaphor in relating it to the ocean, whereas within the arahant, the ocean doesn't swell up. It doesn't cause waves. It doesn't cause suffering. So even in the English, we say that person doesn't cause waves, or that person is causing waves, means that person is a cause of trouble, or that person doesn't cause any trouble. So we have this beautiful image and metaphor that is, again, one of the hallmarks of the Buddha, one of the brand, like in the one of these hallmark itself. A hallmark is a branding. Like, it's just so beautiful. And it really, again, finalizes the answer to his question, how having seen a bhikkhu attain nibbana, not cling to anything in the world. So here again, you can see that a wave, there is no wave, there is no clinging to the world in this ocean. So it's a tremendous image, and a kind of a quality that he's impressing upon the devas. He's impressing upon his crowd. You know, he has to appeal to them with beauty, with awe, with intellect, with knowledge, with insight, with pulling all of this kind of information together, and really impressing them. These are people who are, shall we say, not easily impressed. And the Buddha is able to impress them, answer their question, and appeal to them to make the effort to raise themselves out of their own suffering and to strive for nibbana, because these are beings who would otherwise really not be provoked or instigated into making that kind of an effort. Anyway, so these are some thoughts on this verse.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, as you correctly mentioned, anything you would like to add? Nothing? Okay, yeah. So here in the commentary in Sinhala translation, it is further mentioned that how he become stilled. So basically, it's mentioned now when, one is going through the vicissitudes of the life, ups and downs. When gain happens, when losing happens, lost happens, or then when the fame happens, when infame happens, and when praise happens, and when the kind of the blame happens, still the mind remains equanimous, undisturbed. So that also represent, that is the Thadi. Actually, the here term, Atlodhaming, Atlodham. So the eight types of ups and downs of the life. So that is what even an Arahant has to go through, even the Buddha has to go through. But when such is happening, they are capable of maintaining the calmness, undisturbed or unwavering nature of the mind. So that represents, as he mentioned the simile, so when the ocean becomes deeper and deeper, still it is so strong and so in a way quite deep, but still a huge amount of water is there, but steady, kind of still. And another interesting point is Ussadam bhikkhu na karaya kuhinchi. Ussadam. Ussada means actually ups and downs. So in a way, kind of oscillations. So if we consider the typical worldly being, so there are many, many oscillations in the mind, going up, going down. And if things are favorable, then he starts laughing. And if things are unfavorable, he starts crying. And again, the conceit happens. So I am superior, I am inferior. So likewise, many, many such oscillations are there. But in the Arahant's mind, Ussadam bhikkhuna karaya kuhinchi. So there is no any such kind of wavering or ups and downs or oscillations in the Arahant's mind. So its quietude, its stability, stillness, all are well represented, as Venerable Buddhrakta mentioned through this metaphor. So interestingly, I mean, why he given the ocean? Now ocean, when we think of the depth, I mean, you can't even imagine. I mean, it's a very huge, I mean, if you consider a huge ocean, as we go further and further, it's a completely deep and again vast. So sometimes Buddha mentioned Gambhiro. So Gambhira means quite vast. I mean, you can't even imagine. So such kind of a depth is there. So sometimes when Buddha explained the Dhamma, so another person say he can't understand, or he goes in wrong direction, then he said, yes, Dhamma is Gambhiro. So it's kind of profound. So that profundity, we can say even represented in the deep ocean, where kind of, even though it is still, but it is very profound and fairly deep. So I mean, as he mentioned, I mean, these metaphors are very, very interesting and gives a different perspectives of the situation, not just one way, but we can look at from many different ways. More and more we understand the situation, then we can understand, okay, my goodness, I mean, these kind of interesting features are there in such a stilled mind. So I mean, when we consider simply the still mind, so people might take it as a kind of a very simple thing. It may be simple, yes, but at the same time, it has a very, very deep understanding. Through the understanding, it has become stilled. So one can say, okay, you can achieve stillness, calmness, tranquility through samatha meditation. But here we can't say only that. So the Arahant's mind is not just tranquil through the samatha. Rather, he has a deep wisdom. Through the deep wisdom, it has become completely stilled, unwavering. So he understood the depth of the whole reality. So as a result of that, his mind is completely kind of stilled. So therefore, the depth is there, the deeper profound understanding is there. So that deeper profound understanding represents the deep, the vastness of the ocean. So I think therefore very interesting. And Ussadang bhikkhuna karaya kuhinchi. So if we consider our own minds, so and the typical minds, so there are considerable ups and downs during the daily activities. Okay, how much the mind oscillates, how much mind go to the likes and then the dislikes, attachments, and then the kind of repulsions. So constantly mind is moving. So there is no any kind of stability in that sense. But as one is moving further and further in vipassana, okay, so you may see things, but mind remains calm. You may hear things, but mind remains calm. Say you smell things, but still mind remains calm. You may taste things, but mind remains calm. And even thoughts may come to the mind, it is not disturbed. So the mind's stability, the clarity, how to say, unwavering stability is retained. So that ability may be increasing as one is moving forward. And ultimately, when one becomes an arahant, you can imagine, okay, that it has now has come to the fulfillment, it's complete, distilled. So there are other actually, we can connect this verse with some other verses. Actually, yesterday I have taken one verse from, it's called Nibbana Patisangyutta Desana. It's available in the Udana Pali, I think. So there also Buddha mentioned that when mind is not associating anything, so it is not wavering. If mind associates anything in the sense, what we have to associate the kind of a conditioned phenomena. So if mind associate any kind of a conditioned phenomena, that conditioned phenomena is constantly subjected to some kind of a change. It is constantly impermanent, it's wavering, and it's unstable, unsatisfactory. So if mind associates that, so the mind also start oscillating. Mind also subject to that sort of, shaky situation. And therefore, Buddha mentioned nisitasa chalitang. So if mind associates anything, so for such mind, there is a chalita. There is a wavering, there is a vibration, there is a movement. Anisitasa chalitang natti. If there is no association, there is no wavering. So there is no movements, there is no vibrations, because it has nothing to associate. It doesn't depend on anything. It has its own stability, kind of its own seclusion, its own freedom. So anisitasa chalitang natti. So here we can understand, so when we are moving forward, moving towards the depth of the ocean, so it becomes more and more stable, and it doesn't need to associate anything. It's just sort of surviving by itself, like, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't need to move towards the land or anything, and just it has its own stability. We can say if we consider our own type, say the kind of a confidence, it's there. So understanding is there, and the stillness is there. So likewise, I mean, we can take this verse in many different ways. Anyone else like to add anything you liked? Anything to tell?
Thank you, Swaminathan, yeah. Bhante, for your bringing this sutta into life for us. One thing that, even when you were speaking yesterday about the arahant and how he is unwavering, or she, and it occurred to me, and it's still coming up for me, is this interest in, I heard recently some explanation of loving kindness, which, you know, sometimes, you know, for us, we may think of like something sweet and, you know, caring and like, this emotional mother that's taking care of us or something. But the explanation of loving kindness that I heard was that it's very clear and very settled, and it has equanimity if it's fully developed with the four Brahma Viharas. And it's sort of very pragmatic and very wise, and it has wisdom and compassion together. So I'm just thinking about, you know, this anarahant mind and what Swaminathan was just saying about not becoming involved with anything in the world, or not being, the word he used was associated. Don't become associated. If your mind becomes associated with things that are in the causes that are impermanent, anything in the world, our mind becomes agitated or unsettled, and the arahant is not associating with those things. But then yet the Buddha, I'm just wondering, you know, thinking about what's the impulse to remove suffering in the world. And the Buddha, you know, spent his whole life associating with the world, but not in a, you know, worldly way. I just wonder what is that, you know, that thing that's propelling him to spend his whole life doing this.
Mm. No, sometimes there's a way. Another metaphor is sometimes giving kind of a simile that, you know, the lotus leaf, when it is with a little droplet of water, I mean, it can simply there, but there is no any absorbing quality in the leaf. So likewise, so it can coexist, but there is no any kind of friction. There is no any kind of bond as such. So it's there, by the way. It's on the leaf, but there is no any friction or there is no any real bond between the two. So likewise, we can say even the Buddha, the Arahants, so they are associating the human beings, other fellow beings, but still they are capable of maintaining their seclusion. Mind is not disturbed with the other existing, other happening situations, but they are capable of maintaining their serenity. Very interesting. Yeah. So, and on the other hand, the verse that I have referred, Nisitasya Chalitam, Anisitasya Chalitam Natti. The Anisitasya Chalitam Natti. So the Chalita is the wavering. Chalita is the movement, the vibration. So, but if, as you mentioned, so if there is no any kind of association to any of the conditioned phenomena, so the mind is very much secluded. Mind has its own freedom. Mind has that, when mind has that such freedom, so it is still. So why mind getting disturbed? Because it may be moving. It may be again attached to something. It may be repelled by another thing. And whatever it is being attached, again subject to change. So again, mind also, as a result of that, since it is hooked up with it, again mind also start wavering. But when it is completely released, nothing is associated, though it is sort of experienced in the sort of the freedom. So therefore, it is not that we are talking here that one becomes kind of, as we discussed last time, it is not kind of an indifference that you are not bothering about anyone else, you are completely ignorant about the whole thing, and you neglect about all your situations, and as a result of that, you can remain calm. So that is not what we are talking here. It's a completely different situation where you are completely sensitive, you are fully aware of what is going on, but still you are not wavering. It's a very interesting point. Exactly. So the wisdom is so profound. So you know the reality, you know what the true nature. As a result of that, mind is not interested of getting entangled with these worldly situations. Yeah. Anything? Yeah.
Hasarai Swaminasa, and thank you, Mahasangha, for the comments. So just to go on Bhante's question and the comments that you were saying, Bhante, the Buddha, you know, after his awakening, you know, he was like out in the forest and he was like sitting there, from what I know, and he was like contemplating, should I go back to the world? Should I teach? Like, this like wisdom is like very profound. Like, if it was like hard for me, like, you know, he was kind of thinking that like nobody could understand it. And then the Deva, I think it was a Deva, right?
The Brahma.
Okay.
Sampati Brahma.
Deva?
Sampati Brahma.
Sampati Brahma. Mm-hmm. Okay. Came to him and you know, more or less like asked him to like teach, you know, out of compassion. There are some people in the world, this Sampati.
Dust. Less of dust in their
there,
eyes.
There are some less people in the world who have less dust or ignorance in their eyes. Mm. This Brahman, you say? Yeah. Said to the Buddha, you know, there are some people in the world who have less dust in their eyes, who have less ignorance, and they'll be able to understand the Dhamma more than the, you know, the masses of people. And so please teach out of compassion for them. More or less, that's what this Brahman was saying to the Buddha. So that's what motivated the Buddha. From what I know, that's what motivated him to go back to the world and teach. And you'll notice that the first people he went to the Deer Park in Sarnath, and there was the group of the I think it was the five wandering ascetics. I think, yeah, they were wandering ascetics. And
they were supporting the Buddha during, you know, his practice, his, the 6 years.
Yeah. And then they kind of like gave up on him when he like gave up the austere kind of practices where he's like self-mortifying and stuff. So, but he went to them. He went to those people. And, you know, they had already been living like an ascetic lifestyle. And, you know, then also in the Bahia Sutta, you know, Bahia, the ascetic, was he a woodbark ascetic? Was it a woodbark?
Woodbark, yeah.
Yeah, a woodbark ascetic. So, like, he had already been living a very strict and austere lifestyle. And you know, he, you know, he heard one... You know, kind of, you know, the Buddha said like one thing to him and he became awakened just based off of hearing that. And so, you know, the Buddha was able to understand, you know, that at least, you know, the Brahman, you know, said, you know, please teach out of compassion for the people in the world who can understand, who do have less dust in their eyes or less ignorance. And so the Buddha also, you know, so he was motivated to go back to the world and teach after, you know, that was said to him. And then also, you know, you can see in the suttas, you know, like there are people that he came across who, you know, would hear like one sermon or one thing and they would like, you know, become a stream winner or they would become an arahant, you know, and... you know, the that shows that, you know, the so you can see that there were people that the Buddha encountered in the suttas. When you read the suttas, you can see that there are people that the Buddha encountered that you know, maybe had never heard of his teachings before, but they were already more, you could say, in a position to listen and be receptive. Those are...
Yeah, interesting point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm aware of all these things you're speaking of, but my question is more just really unanswerable unless we're an arahant. But just what is the nature of that mind that is concerned with the world and wants to help and remove suffering? But what is the nature of that mind that you know, what is that caring like, or what is that compassion like? I realized that, you know, that he saw that there were people that he could help to reach arahantship very quickly and that he could do this, but why do it? You know, like what was his, like, association or what would it be like to want that? You know, what would the inner... feeling,
urge, kind of an urge coming to help the others.
Yes, and I guess part of it is there's something in psychoanalysis that Karen Horney, who's a psychoanalysis, brought out, was that people are suffering to a large degree, but yet that there's still a real self within us that has. Goodness and is like wants to be happy and wants joy and wants to have connection with people and like in a healthy way, not in a way of compulsively needing love or something. So this idea of a real self, a self that's not tainted by, you know, excessive hatred or, you know, these things. But so it's something like, you know, what would it be like to be an enlightened being that is caring about the world but not attached to the world?
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, now, even if we don't need to go such far, now, even if one develops mindfulness to some extent, so one becomes more aware of what is going on. And he become more empathetic, and so empathy is one result of the practice. So you are capable of understanding another one's feelings, another one's emotions, another one's situation, and as a result of that, you can help. And so therefore, it may be kind of that. Now, if we consider the Buddha's character, so the wisdom and the compassion are well balanced. So he's not emotionally driven by the compassion. He's being balanced by the wisdom. At the same time, it is not completely selfish kind of a wisdom, but he has the compassion. So it's a very beautiful balance between the wisdom and the compassion. So therefore, he is not emotionally driven by it, but at the same time, he know to whom to help and how to help and all these things. Now, what happens sometimes for us is sometimes we become emotional and we get too much involved and we lose our balance. But on the other hand, the Buddha and the Arahants, okay, they know their mind is very much stable. So even though they are helping and helping another person, but still they are capable of maintaining their integrity. So that is the balance actually we have to, look forward. So how to have such kind of a beautiful balance? Not going too much extreme seclusion or not involvement and you don't bother about anything at all. So that kind of thing. Or you are too much involved and then you lose your balance and you are being driven by those emotions.
Yes,
yeah.
Bhante, that's exactly it. I just wanted to, it seems very important for knowing, because I think many of us, we may want to seclude or be away from people. We might choose the path to do that, but it's actually not about that. It's about being associated, or not associated, but involved.
Being aware, involved.
You have to be able to live with others. We live by helping each other and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You need to add? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for the comments, Mahasangha and Sarai Swaminasa. One could assume that, when a lot of people who are a lot of people in the world, when they want to if they want to fight for a particular cause or something like that, they may be doing it perhaps because it makes them feel good. They're doing it because it makes them feel good. If someone's detached, they can likely see it's just with helping people, someone who's detached, or who's practicing detachment, they can likely understand what needs to be said, when do I need to say it, how should I say it, should I even say anything to this person at all, are they going to be able to be receptive and get it, can I actually help this person, there's another sutta, I think it's from the Samyutta Nikaya, but I'd have to check, and the Buddha was discussing, he was using the simile of a cracked water pot or something like that. It was a water pot, from what I remember. And he was describing the monks, the monastics that who are following him. He describes the lay people who are following him. This is what I remember. And then he was describing the third group he was describing was the followers of other sects. I think it was the wanderers of other sects, or the Brahmins and contemplatives of other sects. I'd have to check, but he was essentially saying from what I remember, he was saying the monks and nuns, they're going to get it. The monastics are going to get it the most. The lay people, they're the middling kind of people. They're going to, get it. And, to an extent. And then the last group, the followers of other sects and whatnot. He's I teach them, with the thought, maybe they might get one sentence, maybe they might understand one sentence. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't expect them to really understand. And, somebody who's practicing detachment, someone who, you can see, the Buddha likely knew, just through his wisdom, just through, the profound wisdom that he had, he was likely able to understand, who was going to be receptive, to the teaching, who could be helped, who could not be helped, and he likely understood that. So if someone's, practicing detachment, they're likely more so able to understand, do I need to, you know, can I help this person, you know, and et cetera. So, you know, rather than just, you know, like wanting to help just because it makes one feel good. You know, it's like I kind of help just because it makes me feel good, or I'm helping just because I'm angered by something that I see in the world, or I'm upset by something I see in the world. I'm helping. It's different when you're practicing detachment. It's you're helping because, you know, you know that it's
the person is receptive and he's capable of understanding.
You know, it's not like an emotional reaction. Mm. Mm-hmm. It's based on wisdom. It's mm-hmm. not based on an emotional reaction. It's mm-hmm. not I'm angry mm-hmm. or I'm hateful or I have ill will or mm-hmm. I'm upset or disturbed by something. It's, you know, I'm actually trying to help. It's from compassion. It's coming from a place of compassion and goodwill. So, yeah. And you'll see, you know, with detachment, you know, comes more compassion. You're not having these like reactionary or like these emotional reactions to things. Like you know, like you're not just making up an example here. You're not like cursing at people out of anger when somebody like I guess I'm just making up an example here again. But like somebody bumps into you and you like curse at them out of anger or something like that. There's a lot less of those emotional reactions. And, you know, maybe you don't feel the need when somebody comes to you and is like asking for help. You're not like shoving your views down their throat or anything like that. You're just listening to them saying what needs to be said, what they're, you know, and it's all from a place of compassion and goodwill. And you're not like shoving your views down their throat or anything like that. And you're just, you know, saying, you know, the right things to be said at that time and, you know, at, you know, during that conversation. So,
yeah,
those are my comments.
Yeah, that's correct. So it may be, I mean, you are not sort of planning and you're not driven by kind of presumptions or your own prejudices. Rather, you are quite receptive. You yourself, the Arahanta I'm talking, I mean, he may himself quite receptive and he's capable of understanding the whole situation. He has a proper view, kind of a balanced mind is there. So as a result of that, he's capable of understanding what is most appropriate. And depending on the context, depending on the situation, then he's acting based on that understanding. So that may be the best way of doing things. So what happens to the others, maybe they are, as you said, become emotional and sometimes they have various biases, maybe cultural biases, their own preconditioning and all these things. As a result of that, he can't understand the situation, he get too much involved and lose the balance. Yeah, very, very, I mean, many things are there. So yeah, anything, Budhirak Dasma, anything you need to add?
Again, just from my own point of view, this detachment is a detachment that's driven by wisdom. It's not driven by you live detached, meaning you live apart from people, or that you live detached, meaning you don't engage with other people. So it's got nothing to do with physicality. I mean, obviously physical seclusion and all of that can be helpful in the training. But there are many kinds of defilements, and those defilements can often be just unveiled depending on conditions. So there's the conditionality of being in the forest and detached. And yeah, you don't run into difficult or, you know, you don't run into too many other people or the density of the crowd. So therefore, you don't meet those kind of defilements, but they're just hiding out. So when you go down to the city and you're in that physicality, there are defilements that will arise depending on that environment, and you meet them and you have to deal with them on the spot. So it's a detachment that's driven by wisdom. And again, this calm and this peace is not the calm and peace of samadhi, where you have time to establish a stillness of the mind based on an object that's calming and you have a nice, peaceful, secluded environment around you. That's extremely conditional and external. This is an internal calm and peace that is our stability that is fundamental to the nature and the properties of wisdom itself. And again, you were asking earlier on about, you know, what was why was the Buddha even bothering to teach other people? Firstly, he was finished, so he had nothing to gain or lose in that action, and he had compassion. So compassion is an intrinsic quality of the mind itself. So it's cultivated and naturally co-developed with wisdom itself. In fact, you can't have wisdom without compassion. I mean, if that was the case, that you could have wisdom without compassion and be detached, you could be a sociopath and happily wise. Or you could be a chicken and just sitting all the time and happily wise. And it's not true. You know, and the same with regards to speech. I mean, Ajahn Chah was quite famous for scolding at times. He could be very firm. And so was the Buddha too, by the way. If you read through, the Buddha is really firm. I mean, especially in the Vinaya, you can see some of his criticism, what he says to the monk of Sikh, the six monks and all this kind of thing. He's really firm. He can really blast people, actually. it's very politely translated into English as, like, you know. But in the Pali itself, it's more, you know, in your face. He definitely said he wasn't happy with this. So it's nothing to do with being all nice and polite and sweetie. And, you know, again, that can be the worst kind of, you know, advice giver. Is somebody who's doing it for your better self, and they're very righteous and superior in that kind of holy superior way, which religious people love. And it's not perfect. Again, I heard this theme of, oh, if you get everything perfectly right. It's not about being perfectly right and wise in this solemn, you know, divine way. You can see it from the different arahants. Some of them are very, not very wise, not very learned, like wise in this holy sense. They just know how not to be reborn. This critical thing. And they may try to advise somebody or give some advice, and then their hand has been bitten, and they'll just withdraw again. You know, it's just not appropriate. Or it's like, I had a friend, a monk. He had this habit of, he would ask me a question, like he was really interested in what I had to say or think, and he knew kind of certain topics that I was interested in, and I had to learn after a while to say to him, "Are you really interested in this?" And because he had this habit of asking a question about something I was interested in. And I knew that if I started to talk about it, like I had learned in previous times, that he really wasn't interested at all. And I would say, "Can you stop and think for a second here? Are you actually interested in knowing what I have to say about this?" And he would say, "Yeah, I'm not actually interested." And I said, "Thanks." You know what I mean? Like, otherwise, I would be just wasting my time enthusiastically talking about one of my favorite things. Uh-huh. And he just did it just to...
Does it trigger you? Just to trigger you?
No, not even trigger me. It was just like he knew I'd be happy to talk about that. And it was kind of like he was trying to be nice. And it wasn't malice. It was just he had this kind of pleasing quality.
Mm-mm-mm.
But he really wasn't interested. You know what I mean? Like, and he had a depth in his own field and area. I had no ability to follow him when he was talking about those things, except I wouldn't ask him, because I just wasn't.
Yeah, I had no interest.
No, I had no knowledge. I couldn't even follow what he was on about. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have no idea. But he would ask me, you know, and it was just to
make you happy.
I just had to. Yeah, he knew I liked this kind of stuff, and I would have to just say, like, in the end, I had to recognize. You know, I had to just say to him, you know, I'd feel myself wanting to tell him about something, and then I kind of go, "Are you really interested?" You know, and he was just like, "No, okay, yeah, thanks." But I don't set this high bar for wisdom, that it's like, you know exactly what the other, and people really go on about mind reading and all of this kind of thing. Like, oh, wouldn't it be great to know what other people are thinking? No, it would be horrible, because it's probably a mess and you don't want to get into that space. I'm happy to not know how to read other people's minds. And I mean, I can understand, I do try to teach occasionally, and I can understand the difficulty, because I can remember myself how I was like I always remember when I was practicing years ago with Godwin, I had no interest in the suttas. I mean, I was just there to meditate. I was in Nilambe. It was a beautiful place. It was a lovely center and everything was great. And I didn't need this damn sutta class and discussion. It was just like a long, tedious, boring. I had no interest. We used to read the Majjhima Nikaya. No interest. Never. And then years later, after lots of practice, it became fascinating. It was super fascinating, the suttas. And it was just naturally, like, I think some of the ignorance had burnt off or whatever. And this became really interesting. And now when I read stuff like this Sutta Nipada is extremely difficult text. Mm. Like, I can really understand why it's not normally taught. You can really pass it off as poetic and... Mm. You know, kind of, I don't know, if hard to catch what he's talking about.
Yeah, that thing.
Really hard. Hmm. And you can see all the different translations of this. Like, I have two translations in front of me at the moment. This is really hard to translate because it's got and we are missing so much. I don't have the appreciation of the meter and the rhyme. It'd be like reading rap these days. Like, I find it hard to read rap, you know, because I don't know what they're talking about. I don't know their metaphors and I don't know how they're even the stresses. You know what I mean? Like, if you read this rap and you hear them singing it, it's completely different. Like, it's a real skill. I've never developed it. I've never tried it. I was a pre-rap guy, you know? And I feel the same with these verses. Like, I'm missing all the beauty of this poetry.
Actually, you can't get it from the translation. Actually,
no,
you can get it from the original Pali statements. So there are the Buddha has sometimes, as you mentioned, the poetic and again the rhythm and the, I don't know, I can't understand. I don't know the English term.
And he's fitting into
very beautiful, exact, I mean, how things are connected.
Styles as well. Like, so anybody who would have really been familiar with this would have so enjoyed it just for the talent, the brilliance
of
this. Yeah.
Exactly. It is not just putting the words and it is not just putting the meaning, but how beautifully crafted the verse itself has a very beautiful kind of aesthetic aspect as well.
There's a definite meter to it and everything. Mm. So, I can understand why this is so difficult. But we have to relate it back again to that experience. So, I notice a difference. Like, last week, I remember there was this discussion about where was in this... What was it again? The Satipatthana in the previous verse. And I was like, whoa, you're really missing that the Buddha is not talking... He's not directly talking about Satipatthana here. He's talking about an immediate experience. The same with this idea about the ocean today. Like, really... Put yourself on that ocean. Your question again was, you know, what is the Arahant's mind like? You have to put yourself like a little boat out on that ocean and just be there and experience it. And that's why I said to you, I found it astonishing that somebody who, as far as I know, was not a sailor, is talking about the deep ocean. And he's telling you about the experience of being in that deep ocean, that it isn't rising and falling like in a wave manner. In the same way, there is movement, there is things happening.
That's a flow. Still, there may be a flow.
No. There's not a flow, but actually, there is the there's the impact. The oceans are banging into each other, and they cause a kind of a shock wave to move through the water. So like the tsunami. The tsunami is moving through the water, and you feel it. But it doesn't manifest as a wave, like a wave hits the land, right? So there is a shock wave moving through the water. And so the navigators of old who are going across the oceans, they became masters of knowing which way the shock waves were moving. And that's how they could direct themselves, orientate themselves on the ocean. So they knew directions based on these shock waves moving through, even though there's no obvious waves happening. And you had to be very sensitive to the sensation of the water to determine. Like, I'm just saying to you, like, if you want to know what the Arahant's mind is like, put yourself out in that ocean and just really feel that. And that's what you have to do with these verses as well. You have to kind of
be in that situation. Like,
yeah, allow yourself to go into what the Buddha is talking about. And the same with the music and the metaphor and these other qualities that when he uttered these verses, you kind of have to, you feel it, you know. You're a jazz guy, you should know.
Well, I won't get into that, but on these premises, but I just want to say, well, you know, I think anybody, if we dedicate to meditation at least for some time and do it consistently, you begin to feel the calming happening. So then maybe you don't have to actually go into the ocean, but if, like, for instance, I've been meditating for a very long time, for 22 years, and I got to a point where I've become very still and calm, but lately I've been observing and trying to give reports on where I am with my meditation, and I do see that I can come to a place where the mind has become unassociated with phenomena that are going on, and so I'm getting a taste. I have a taste of that, you know, that where this is headed towards. But as I'm getting directed in kamatans, it's also being able to do walking meditation and have that arise, and being able to be in daily activities or in a conversation with somebody, and also having the same experience of just not becoming attached or concerned or having any swellings arise of lust, anger, hate. So I just wanted to say, you know, we can gradually learn to what's
the difference with
challenge? I'll say when I started meditating when I was playing music, and I quit playing about 5 years of meditation, but I did notice my playing changed because I used to be very critical of myself, but I'd got to where I was just sort of riding the wave. You know, you go out there and it's a good metaphor is you're not getting thrown around by the wave, but you're just like riding on top of the wave and not... not becoming attached to a self, sort of. You're more riding the energy. And that was where I was
like adjusting the situation? Excuse me? Adjusting yourself? Yeah. Or accepting, maybe?
I don't know. It was just like a feeling. It was like I can't even put it into words. It's like being without...
No friction.
Yeah, just... I guess you have to be a surfer to know how to ride the wave. And right. Just, you know, although, you know, if you fall one way or the other, you're going to be swept away and injured or whatever. But if you can find that, just that balancing point where you're not falling to one side or the other. So it's like something like that. Mm-hmm. I've never been asked that question.
Yes, interesting.
I can just imagine that that's why I asked you the question, actually, was I think in jazz you get carried along. As you mentioned, you ride the wave. If you're really good at it, you're carried along with the music and the other group members. Mm-hmm. But the difference here in the ocean is that the wave is just passing through you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you it's just passing through you, whereas with the jazz you're carried along.
Mm.
It's an excitement. And and it's a wave that's bringing you along, and you're listening. It's a very deep listening in the jazz. You're listening, but in the ocean, you're listening, but it's also just passing through you. There's a difference. Yeah, there is no difference in that sense, and nature is happening, and everything is just arising and passing through you. You know what I mean? You're not obstructing it or as it were sticking to it.
You're deeply accepting that sense.
Yeah, it's just passing through. Nature is passing through, whereas like everybody else wants to jump on the wave because that's exciting and cool.
Yeah, so actually we have come almost 1 hour. evam titho anejasa. Now actually we can take another point here. Titho. Titho means still. Anejasa means that not wavering. So there is no shocking or there is no movements. So still and again completely, I mean, stable. Titho and anejasa. Ussadang. Vikuna karayye kuhinchi. So that means, I mean, so probably we can take in another different way. So we can take completely to the end point that the Arahant's mind is completely still and unwavering and there is no oscillations. And here, before that we can say, if we connect this to the, say, the Vipassana practice, so time to time one may reach this state. Say it is not the complete Arahantship. What I am mentioning is where when the wisdom is grown to some extent, say your mind get released. So now there are no attachment, there are no grasping, there are no associations. And while being there, so another statement here is Ussadam bhikkhu na karayya. So now you are very much like observing yourself. Are there still some oscillations available in the mind? I mean, am I completely still? Am I capable of going through, as he mentioned, I mean, am I allowing all the waves to go in through without I being disturbed? So when a disturbance happens, am I going up or down? So it's kind of an observation in a way. So you yourself is experimenting with yourself. Okay, now I am capable of maintaining kind of a release, kind of a freedom. So am I not oscillating now? So it is not that, I don't know whether you are immediately become an Arahant or rather you are capable of achieving that stability for a fragments, say for a short period. And then during that time, now you are further and further enhancing. How you enhancing is that understanding, okay, now oscillation happened, how much it has gone up, how much it has gone down. Another time oscillation happened, how much it has gone up, how much it has gone down. So that the amplitude may be reducing as you are moving forward. So it is not immediately you become the bottom line. It's not that you immediately become kind of stable line. But the amplitude become less and less and less. Ultimately it becomes slower and maybe you become kind of still. So this Ussadam bhikkhuna karayya kuhinchi give a kind of another implication that one has to take care, okay, even though the oscillation, even though the vicissitudes are happening, ups and downs of lives are happening, okay, you be just quiet. You just maintain your relaxed attitude. Maintain your stability. So there's kind of an invitation, kind of a direction is also there. Kind of instruction is there. So actually, why I am telling this is now, say, if you can remember in Mangala Sutta, so there are also interesting verse, kind of a last verse, puttassa loka dhammehi chittang yassa na kampati. So when you are being impact, you are being attacked by these ups and downs of the life, but your mind is chittang na kampati. So your mind is not wavering. So same direction is shown there also. I mean, you can't get rid of the ups and downs of the life. Even Buddha can't get rid of. But how you are maintaining the stability? How quickly you can adjust to yourself, how quickly, that's what we are talking in the resilience, how quickly you can come back, how quickly you can return back to your normalcy. Yes. So, yeah, that also we can say. Yeah. Yeah. So those like, I mean, in that sense, actually, the the last statement give a kind of a practice instruction also. So while you become stable, I mean, when your mind is released, now just maintain that and see whether there are still oscillations happen due to the ups and downs of the external conditions of your own life experiences. So there may be possibilities, but okay, return back to that normalcy, like mentioned in the Indriya Bhavana Sutta in Majjhima Nikaya. So Buddha mentioned, okay, you may see a beautiful thing, your mind might get agitated, but don't be there. So you better come back to the neutral, stable, released state. So if you see a kind of a bad thing, or your mind can go a little bit shaky, but don't be in that state. Just return back to that kind of equanimous, released and stable state. It's a kind of a practice. It is not that one become immediately an Arahant maybe. So you may time to time, as a result of the practice, you may experience that unassociated state, non-grasping state. While being there, now you still have to further familiarize with that state. you need to consolidate that state. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think we can wind up then. Today also we have covered one verse, but very interesting verse. I mean, the metaphor is very, very profound, very, very interesting metaphor. And we can use it in our own lives, whether am I in the ocean or am I in the middle or am I still on the beach making a lot of noise. So, yeah, exactly. So just to remember, okay, so Buddha has mentioned this kind of a simile, to which direction I am moving. So I invite Venerable Buddharakti to make your beautiful sharing of merits.
We can just imagine again, we're very peaceful out on that boat in the middle of the ocean, and we're not bobbing up and down too much. And in that open-minded space, we can also share the merit of this beautiful mind state with all beings. Like, again, this question, how do we share these teachings with other beings? So we've received these teachings from the Buddha. We're in that beautiful mind state of being on that open ocean water. And we also wish for that all beings be suffering free. That great compassionate feeling, just as I am suffering free in this place in the middle of the ocean, and may all beings be suffering free. And just like that breathing in and breathing out, that I'm suffering free and all beings are suffering free. And we share this great meritorious feeling with all beings in all directions. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu.